the Sons of Liberty, Mark Twain, Mae West, Ken Kesey's Merry Pranksters, the marathon dancers of the 1930s, hippies, yippies, hip-hop performers, punk rockers. They were all about irreverence, rebellion, and fun. John Beckman, a professor of English at the Naval Academy, says that from colonial days on, free-spirited, anti-establishment hellraisers have contributed to America's diversity and its democratic character. His provocative book, American Fun, re-examines our very notion of the word. He argues that fun is not the packaged and passive entertainment of sitcoms, but getting out there with a bunch of people and doing something you enjoy, and if it outrages the establishment, so much the better. John Beckman on American Fun, after the news. Welcome back to Midday, our second hour. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. When we learn about America's earliest colonial days, we celebrate the Puritans who settled Massachusetts and built a society based on piety, propriety, sobriety, hard work, thrift, and stealing land from the Indians. They're important but otherwise tedious qualities that can turn life into a real slog. Our next guest reminds us that at the very same time William Bradford and his followers built their Temple of God in New England, another leader was pioneering an entirely different lifestyle nearby. Thomas Morton founded Marymount Colony in the spring of 1627, populated it with freed slaves and indentured servants, Indians and other outcasts from Puritan society who delighted in freedom from repressive rules, frequently took to strong drink, danced around the maypole, and otherwise brought European traditions of mass misbehavior to the American continent. The Puritans couldn't abide people having all this fun nearby and drove the residents of Marymount away at gunpoint within a year. But John Beckman, a novelist and professor of English at the U.S. Naval Academy, argues that those rowdy Marymountians had a profound impact on the nation's history and character, establishing a tradition that he calls American Fun, which happens to be the title of a new cultural history that details the exploits of rule breakers and establishment tweakers, ranging from the well-lubricated mob that enjoyed itself at the Boston Tea Party, through the barroom brawlers, hoaxsters, and practical jokers of the Wild West, to the zoot suiters of the 40s, to Ken Kesey's drug-fueled merry pranksters, the yippies of Abby Hoffman's 1960s, and a modern hip-hop movement. John Beckman revels in America's riots, revolts, protests, happenings, and be-ins, which he says help shape American democracy. Along the way, John Beckman offers a provocative definition of the meaning of the word fun. Real fun, he writes, quote, is one pleasure that can't be felt. Fun, like sex, must be had. Watching a sitcom or playing a video game isn't fun, it's passive, solitary entertainment. Mosh pit surfers and people who join flash mobs are having fun, he says. It's something humans do together. John Beckman is a professor of English at the Naval Academy, a novelist whose first book, The Winter Zoo, is a tale of politics, adventure, love, and debauchery in post-Soviet Poland that earned a notable book mention by the New York Times. Now he's turned his attention to American history, culture, and politics with this nonfiction title, American Fun, A Century of Joyous Rebellion. It's available from Pantheon, and it proves you can write seriously about having a good time while losing your sense of humor. So, John Beckman, it's nice to have you on the show. Thanks for visiting us.
It's great to be here, Dan. Thank you for having me.
From Annapolis, yeah. What got you to this theory, this idea? How did this one dawn on you?
Gradually. I suppose it dawned on me after a long childhood in Catholic school where all of my friends in our kind of remote Midwestern Mississippi River town of Dubuque were pushing back against the nuns and the priests and our parents and police in order to kind of define ourselves and have fun. So in that sort of stolid upbringing, we found the joy in rebellion. And so when I grew up and became, I guess, more of a scholar of American history and went looking for this pleasure, which I still, I guess, enjoyed and revered in a certain way. I was pleased to find it turning up in many places throughout American history, from the very beginning in the 1620s to kind of what we do today.
It's funny. If you said, here I go with that word, funny, but if you said American fun to people, they would say, well, a visit to an amusement park or watching a Seinfeld rerun, something like that. That's fun, but you know, no, that's not what you're talking about.
No, and I was aware in writing this book that that was exactly the dominant understanding of fun that I was pushing back against, and that sense of entertainment as fun, which is, we use the word fun for that, really rose to ascendancy in the Gilded Age in the late 19th century, and it's never really left our consciousness, even as we use this term to refer to the sort of wild, rollicking, rule-breaking, risk-taking fun that we also call fun.
And not everyone takes part in fun. Some people just observe it, right? Others take part.
Yes, I guess that would always be the case.
Well, you have to be a little bit subversive, right, for some of the fun you're talking about.
You might surprise yourself by how subversive you are when you find yourself falling in with other people's fun. You know, it's kind of a truism: the more the merrier. But a lot of this fun that appeared, maybe was instigated by subversive sorts throughout American history, was so infectious that it drew in large numbers, such that by the 1920s, a mainstream American society was behaving like that. Wild fringe group of Marymount that you described.
Well, let's go there. I think we should march through history with fun with John Beckman.
And
we'll stick to chronology because I think that's good. So okay. Marymount, this is great. This is like outside of Boston and a place called Quincy.
Well, what's now called Quincy.
Quincy, Massachusetts, city of presidents. And so tell us about this, because here's his Puritanism, his stolid, gray, dark, black and white Puritanism.
That's kind of our cartoonish understanding of Puritanism, but it was a strict authoritarian way of life and belief system, especially as kind of enforced and practiced by the Pilgrims, who didn't exactly call themselves Puritans. They were kind of sneeringly called separatists by others, but you know, the ones who arrived on the Mayflower and they started Plymouth Plantation in 1620. They built this spiky fortress against the wilderness to wall out all things wild and weird and Native Americans, and to wall in their own sort of stolid ideology and kind of this self-denying ideology that all people are depraved. And then a couple of years later, this English pettifogger lawyer, Thomas Morton, whom you introduced, just came over to the New World on vacation, and he loved what he saw. He loved the wilderness. He was very intrigued by Native Americans, and he came back about 4 years later and established his own colony, Marymount, where he encouraged these bond servants to sort of throw off their chains and to explore their own freedom and, you know, what they considered to be fun. And he sort of guided them, as you pointed out, with this Elizabethan ethic of hedonism.
So he comes over and he thinks, what, the Pilgrims, the establishment of the people who established the Massachusetts colony are missing all the fun in this new country, this new wild and open territory?
He did distinctly think that. And his book, New English Canaan, which he put out in the 1630s, it put it explicitly that he felt that the Native Americans in particular were more humane and had a richer culture than the Pilgrims. And he thought that there was all of this fun to be had in the mixing of all these kind of ethnic identities. And he was an avid drinker and an avid satirist and an avid dancer. And he brought all of these kind of sensibilities together into this fun little
colony. And he liked doing it right outside where all the everything else was taking place. Right?
Oh, yeah.
He liked sort of like being there, and it was sort of in your face a bit, right?
Yeah, he was kind of pugnacious about it, such that after a certain period of influencing the rest of the colonies or making it possibly look attractive, Miles Standish, who led the Plymouth Plantation militia, took the trip, the 30-mile trip from Plymouth to Marymount and cut down their maypole and, as you said, put Thomas Morton in chains and packed him back to England.
Right.
It was he was a threat.
So he was the first, can we call him the first Hellraiser?
We could.
We were speaking with John Beckman about his book, American Fun. And as I said, we were marched through a chronology here. I think the story of the Adams brothers is really great. This is the story of John Adams.
Right.
Of course, a lot of people know him. And Sam Adams, a lot of beer drinkers know him.
Right, yeah.
This is very interesting, the two personalities. And I really think it gets right to the heart of what you're describing in this book.
In many ways, it does. I wouldn't want to give too cartoonish an impression of Samuel.
Oh, please don't.
an impression of Samuel Adams as being a great beer drinker. He was recognized
a
as
beer
having...
a maker, right?
It's not even clear that he made beer, but we remember him that as a beer maker when we drank Sam Adams today.
Well, who was he? I mean, we know who John was. But.
Well, he was the great kind of radical politician of early Massachusetts, and he and James Otis were very effective in spreading kind of moral sense philosophy among the people and you know, through their screeds and broadsides and encouraging what were already the sort of fulminating crowd actions of the period, especially that were rising up from the docksides by the Jack Tars who were resisting impressment by the British and seeing real political potential among the common people and within the mixing of classes, a potential that John Adams didn't necessarily deny, but he was frightened of, and he himself resisted.
Oh, really? He didn't want to be a part of that at first.
No, the way he presents himself in his diaries, which are this great resource for understanding that whole era, he wrote very vividly about the period. He seems like kind of a wallflower. The way he presents himself walking into a tavern and watching other people having fun suggests that he was intimidated by it and that he saw a kind of diabolical potential in that, especially as a political force. And he initially, he defended the captain who fired on the snowball throwers in the Boston Massacre, and he initially opposed the Boston Tea Party until it was effective, and then he said, you know, it was great.
Well, that gets us to the story,
right.
Doesn't it?
Right,
that's where the two brothers, the two ideas, Sam Adams' idea and John Adams' idea kind of come together in the Boston Tea Party, right, would you say?
I would say there's the sharpest distinction in their two roles in the Boston Tea Party. John Adams' absence of a role, basically. But Samuel Adams, among other kind of frontline politicians of the period and the Sons of Liberty, were responsible for organizing thousands of people against the Tea Act. And
so I misunderstood. So John was still not a participant in this.
Well,
he was
a politician, but he actually in the months the weeks preceding it kind of suggested other means, and he thought maybe even we should comply with the Tea Act. And Samuel Adams was among the I wouldn't say necessarily the majority, but among the voice of the people who were encouraging this response to the Tea Party.
So how did this come about? You say it was done as a protest, a statement about liberty, the desire for liberty,
right,
not to pay this tax, of course, on the tea. But also there was some revelry involved in this, some fun. There's a certain rowdiness to it that inspired people.
Yeah, I think like any really well-turned-out prank, it was a delicate balance between discipline. It was very well planned, and they had all the right people involved and ready to go at just the right time. But when it had to happen, it required this kind of uprising, and this real sort of, it was quiet revelry when they finally got down to the docks, but in the approach, everyone was dressed in disguise as Mohawks, as they called them. Their faces were painted, and they were war whooping through the streets, and they were shouting, Boston Harbor, a tea party tonight, or a teapot tonight. And there was this kind of general upswelling of fellow feeling that brought it about.
So they were psyched to do it.
But I think they were
could
psyched,
be, there
yeah.
could be some serious consequences. Could there not be fear among them, too?
There could have been fear. There was you know, reference among them to how much fun it was, which probably suggests that there was also fear. But there could have been consequences, and that's where the discipline, I think, comes in, which was also instrumental to the fun. They all kept each other in check from not stealing the tea for themselves. The only person who was actually physically pummeled, as it's reported, was someone who did try to steal some tea for himself. And they were very strategic in only unloading the tea into the harbor. But in that sort of mass participation, in that very kind of surgical strike, it seemed that there was a lot of mass enjoyment.
John, how do you know? I mean, how do you know that this dynamic was a part of that?
That it was fun.
Yeah.
Well, you have to cobble together lots of different facts. There's I think it was a shoemaker's apprentice named Samuel Sprague, who was off on his way to a date, and he saw the throngs passing through the streets, and he didn't go to his date, but said he wanted to get his share of the fun, and put some makeshift stove black on his face and join them. There are the reports of the whooping and the whooping heard from the streets. Mm-hmm. And then there is even, and I think this might be most significant, the reports afterwards by both John and Samuel Adams. John privately referring to what a great sensation everyone commonly felt, and then Samuel Adams kind of baiting the other colonies to follow suit and saying, you know, can you too, you know, show this much, you know, fellow feeling and expression of a sort of civic revolt.
So did John Adams come around?
He came around when it worked well, yeah, the next day.
Now, how do you compare the experience from your understanding of the Tea Party, the original Tea Party, with the Tea Party today, the Tea Party of 21st century America? Are they having fun?
I would have to get a little bit closer to, you know, the street view of the Tea Party, which seems to be becoming much more of a legislative resistance these days.
Yeah, I guess it's still out in the street a little bit,
right.
but it's gone from being in the street and these sort of spontaneous demonstrations to legislative and electing members of Congress.
Right. I suppose if the distinction that I would like to make, maybe in terms of the argument of this book, is that to the extent that there is a sense of radical civility guiding the Tea Party, that they feel that this is actually, that their motives are actually good for all of America, and that they don't want to promote an exclusive politics, which you get evidence of at some of their demonstrations. You know, there is evidence of racism and exclusivity that I think is more vicious than actually fun. But if to the extent that there may be this upswelling of sort of joyous belief in American patriotism, that could be fun.
John Beckman is our guest, visiting us today from the Naval Academy, where he's a professor of English, author of this new book, American Fun, the story about happy subversives who delighted in banding together to tweak and embarrass the establishment over mm-hmm. time. We talked about the Sons of Liberty in colonial times. We'll move on to barroom brawlers and pranksters, the Wild West, yuppies of the 1960s, punk rockers, and hip hoppers today. A short break on Midday. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. John Beckman, our guest, American Fun, his book, Four Centuries of Joyous Revolt. Some members of the Boston Tea Party were drunk, right?
Yeah, there was a great deal of drinking beforehand too. If you're looking for ingredients for fun, you know, there was a mixing up rum punch as they were okay. putting on their makeup.
No Sam Adams beer that we know of.
Not that we know of, no.
We're going to push ahead through history. I said we march chronologically here, and I think we'll jump ahead to the Wild West here.
That's fine with me.
Because there's a lot there, right, that you look at. This is a good source of rowdy fun, pranksters.
It's a sinewy era.
Tell us about it. How does this figure into American fun?
Well, I suppose in an unlikely way, because when we think of the real conditions of the Wild West, which I guess we might start with 1849 and the Argonauts going to California after the discovery of gold in Sutter's Mill, whether they're going through Panama or they're going by land across the basically the desert. By mm-hmm. the time they get there, and they're in pretty rough shape, and they're landing in some pretty rough conditions, and it's many of them are rough folk, and they have to find a way to get along, and a lot of that was done by vigilantism or just simple criminal justice, and there was a great deal of racism that was meted out on Native Americans, and there are people who were just simply dying from the physical conditions as well. So there's plenty to argue that it was not fun at all to be in the Wild West. But what I discover in my research is that in these precise conditions, from kind of San Francisco, branching out into the minefields, this largely male, roughneck population discovered all sorts of almost dainty ways of getting along with each other, so they didn't have to kill each other, and so they could form
almost
civil society.
Almost dainty ways, John?
Almost dainty ways. Yeah, so if you look at what that the journalist and draftsman J.D. Borthwick called miners' balls, he happened upon, and actually this is a phenomenon that you find all throughout the journals and journalism and travelogues of the period, this hotel ballroom, really rustic hotel ballroom, all male, where you had all of these miners with big bristling beards and bowie knives and revolvers dancing these couples dances. And these are traditionally male-female dances, but they would take the respective roles, and these would go on in really sort of almost with mosh pit vengeance all afternoon long.
Really?
And in between
there wouldn't
dances.
Be any cross-dressing.
Well, to this extent that they would, the ones who took the female parts would put this little patch over their private parts to kind of indicate that they were the taking the female role. So very little cross-dressing. But
so there weren't any women folk?
Oh, there were women folk, and more in the cities and in the minefields, and okay. Often they were prostitutes. But it was an overwhelmingly male population for much of the 50s.
Yeah. Where else do you find fun in the West?
Well, another way that they kind of engendered civility among people who otherwise might not be inclined to get along is by pulling pranks on each other. It seems that, you know, April Fool's Day, which we enjoyed yesterday, was held in high esteem throughout the minefields and in San Francisco in particular. And all year round, they would kind of pick out who was gullible, who was weak, who was cowardly, who was overly violent or greedy, and kind of crack jokes at their expense and kind of train them in how to behave well through the practice of pranks.
Is this necessarily an American, early American behavior? Is this something that went on in other cultures, other countries?
Well, I'm an Americanist, and so yeah.
Looking at this strain in our history.
I'm looking at this strain, and I can't tell whether or not this was happening everywhere around the world, but it certainly was proper to these conditions. It may have been proper to many international conditions, but
how is it part of, like, what you just
described? Because a lot of these people were also coming from Europe or coming from around the world, Chile.
But how is it part of revolt, necessarily? Or isn't, you're saying all American fun is or isn't?
This can be traced to revolt in a certain way as well, because during the same period back in the Eastern, the States, as it was called, there was the popular culture was largely reformist, and it was domesticating, and people were encouraged to behave well with polished manners, and that's how people were getting along in the States. They were becoming more citified.
Right.
And there was this kind of male resistance to that, and you can see this specific resistance, especially in the journalism that they would be sending back to the States, the sort of mockery that they would send back to the States from the West, you know, pointing out that they can drink as much as they want, and they will have wild dances with other men, and they will pull pranks on each other, and that is a rough sort of Western lifestyle that they took pride in, kind of in resistance to the increased citification of the East. So, there's revolt.
Let's bring into the story here Mark Twain.
I
wish we could bring him into the studio.
No,
we can't do that.
There's a chair for him right there.
I would love to have him here. But he sort of figures in at this juncture in your
Definitely.
Telling of this of American fun.
Yeah, he had gone out west with his brother Orion as a young man because he really didn't have anything else to do. And he was a horrible failure, as he himself reports after he got there. He was a terrible prospector, and he was terrible at all the things you had to do to survive until he found his calling in journalism. And he began writing for the Virginia City Enterprise in Nevada. That's where he had gone, the Washoe Territory. And what he particularly excelled at was lying in print, which is what there were so many newspapers, and there were like 12 newspapers at one point in Virginia City, and they were all kind of at war with each other, creating this falsified news and poking fun at each other, and there were duels in the streets between editors.
Sounds like fun.
It was fun. See, that's the fun I'm talking about. That's exactly the stuff I'm talking about.
Editors would actually duel?
Oh, yeah, certainly. There was a famous duel.
So Twain would make up stories.
A notable story was the Empire City Massacre, in which he told the story of a let me see if I can get this right. A man who massacred his entire family and is, with a butcher knife or something like that, and then massacred this. He killed this person, the one witness to the event, with a slash across the throat. But this guy galloped into town and, like, reported the the massacre to the town of Carson City just as he died.
Okay. And Twain wrote this up as if it was a news story?
As if it were a news story, and it's a gruesome detail, although he dropped little hints in there that led on that it was a hoax. But all throughout his readership and all throughout the West, people took this as fact. And many of them were actually offended by it. And so he actually found the limit of their tough sensibilities, mm-hmm. and went beyond that. And so he was a real expert at kind of toughening up the West through the print.
That's very interesting. So mm-hmm. so that became a practice of Twain all through his life, right? To exaggerate, to basically tell stories, funny stories, and
right, to exaggerate, jokes. To satirize, actually, and to put the readers on their back feet.
Yeah. And actually, did he carry out any pranks himself, Twain? Or did you consider this kind of journalism a prank?
Well, this was journalism, you know, was kind of his major form of pranking, but he was of a collection of journalists who were always, you know, pulling pranks on each other as well. His best friend of the era and roommate, Dandy Quill, was his kind of in leagues with him in this.
You know, I must say, in preparing for this show today, I was thinking about the depiction of the Wild West in movies, because
sure,
that's
course,
how
yes.
most of us get our...
Rather grim and somber, right?
Yeah, lots mm-hmm. of shooting, lots of people mm-hmm. dying, you know, right?
right?
And if not for Blazing Saddles, right. there wouldn't be any,
right, exactly.
any anything funny about
Mel Brooks
it.
Got it, yeah.
Yeah, I did like the John Wayne film McClintock, because there was some humor in that
mm-hmm,
one.
Mm-hmm.
There's some other John Wayne films where there's right. some humor here and there, but
right.
mostly it's, especially in the modern films,
right.
it's a very severe depiction and brutal scene out there. There isn't much that's going on that's very funny. So
yeah, I think that was our popular impression, especially from the 1950s forward. And
yeah,
then, you know, right down to Sam Peckinpah's Spaghetti Westerns and Dirty Harry.
Yeah,
but
pretty grim, severe, and brutal.
Right.
But there was some room for fun, you have found in your research.
Well, certainly
it had to be.
If you read the writing of the period, and especially from the journalist's standpoint, there was a very high sense of humor, and there's a playfulness that pervaded the society that kind of gave the lie to that dark.
Okay,
impression.
Now here's a place we're gonna go to slavery here.
Oh,
okay.
Sorry.
Now here's a place you don't associate with this word on the cover of your book, fun at
By
all.
By no means. No.
So please take your time on this one and explain to us why you found evidence of American fun among slaves.
Well, I think this is a pretty good transition from the Wild West, which I began as describing as a pretty abject place to live, right? And in really abject conditions. And certainly there have been no worse conditions for American democracy and for Americans than to live in slavery. And I think what the slaves often did in order to resist those conditions, and what enslaved Americans did in order to assert their humanity in really physical and active ways, broaden our perspective of what it meant to live during that period and how you could possibly survive slavery. A very strong community of people, of Americans, came out of those awful conditions, and I attribute a lot of that to the dances that they would develop, in which they could communicate with each other and enjoy each other in ways that were often forbidden or were overlooked by the masters, by the jokes. There's a very elaborate comedy that is conveyed by their folk tales during the period, particularly the Brother Rabbit tales, that both educated them in how to resist the tyrannical authority while mocking it and doing so in safe ways, while also kind of preserving their own community civility. The songs of the period, it was a human triumph, the way African Americans enjoyed themselves, whether in sanctioned celebrations like Christmas time or in secret celebrations all throughout the year.
So there would be times when they'd have a break from their labors to celebrate in secret or in private. The master wouldn't be aware of what was going on or have any understanding of the mocking nature of some of their celebrations?
Well, yes. Sometimes it would happen at night, throughout the night, when they were supposed to be in their cabins. They would rather play than sleep, you might think. often it would happen right there during work time. They became very good. They, in the purest Marxist sense, they didn't own the fruits of their labors, so their labor had to be turned into something else. So often through from Kuhn-Jeins to corn shuckings in particular, they made the work itself into their fun as opposed to the master's labor.
Now, I want to bring into the story here John Beckman, Frederick Douglass, mm-hmm. the abolitionist, Baltimore, right. Frederick Douglass.
Exactly.
Who wouldn't approve of this, right? He had a very stern view of how slaves should behave.
Yeah, right? he vocally disapproved of it in famously in his narrative. And he... In particular, he made an example, and he makes a very plausible case of the Christmas holidays that he felt were these kind of topsy-turvy carnival vacations. I mean, that wasn't just an opinion, that were given to slaves in order to get them to drink as much as they possibly could till sickness, and in order to have them, in the master's eyes, despise liberty enough to want to go back to work. And he thought that during this period, slaves classed off, that a small upper class of slaves worked for themselves during the Christmas holidays, and they repaired their clothing and their homes, and that the larger class of slaves, in his terms, partied and played into the master's hands.
And played into a stereotype.
And played into a stereotype.
He was very concerned about, right?
He
thought even as slaves that they should be serious, in purpose, industrious.
I'm not sure that I would say that he was defending in this passage against a stereotype, but more defending a way of life, a practice that he felt was important. An interesting counterpoint to Frederick Douglass is a contemporary of his who was also an abolitionist and who is very popular these days because his book 12 Years a Slave has been made into a major Oscar award-winning film, and Solomon Northup. And in his book, he speaks absolutely differently about the slave holidays, the Christmas holidays, and says that this is the moment when he has seen slaves most human, most kind of enjoying and expressing their humanity through the very things that Frederick Douglass opposes, through dancing, through singing, through sports, through just kicking back in a certain way on their own terms.
Mm-hmm. And so you find in this story, mm-hmm. in this chapter in American history, in slavery, and you find this strain, again, this strain of irreverence, desire to mm-hmm. tweak, poke, mock a little bit, and have fun.
And I see it developed in highly sophisticated ways that have proved to be very durable throughout American history and have done immeasurable good work for American culture and American democracy.
John Beckman is our guest, visiting us today from the U.S. Naval Academy, where he's a professor of English. His book is American Fun, Four Centuries of Joyous Revolt. You're listening to Midday on WYPR. We'll take a short break here and come back and talk to John some more. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. John Beckman is our guest in this hour of the show, who's at the Naval Academy, a professor of English and a novelist. But this is a work of nonfiction, some political and cultural history, certainly a very different take on it, and an enjoyable read, American Fun, Four Centuries of Joyous Revolt. John, who is the publisher of your book?
Pantheon.
Pantheon, right. I mentioned that earlier.
Okay. You can't tell from the spine that you're looking at. There's a spray paint over it.
Oh, right. Oh, that's right. Yeah, there's a little bit of graffiti on the cover here. So as we move along, we get into the late, let's say the late 19th century here. This P.T. Barnum is looming around, right? And you don't care too much for P.T. Barnum because of what he kind of does to fun. He kind of packages it and presents it to people, and then fun becomes something less of something you have an experience, more of something you watch and look at. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, I guess I have very complicated feelings about P.T. Barnum, I guess as well we should. He's kind of a turncoat against fun because he grew up in the Northeast where there was, a strong prankster tradition which he appreciated and participated in, and he commodified. He became, in the antebellum period, the author himself of great hoaxes that brought lots of people out into the streets or across the East River to see a great pack of buffalo that, you know, wasn't all he cracked it up to be. So, you know, he understood pranks. But then after the Civil War, his entrepreneurial spirit, which was also absolutely strong from birth in him, generated this cultural juggernaut, and he engineered all of these ways of turning the people's fun into mass amusement. And he was no longer disguising, or rather no longer kind of flaunting the humbug of his hoaxes, but kind of building them into this kind of pernicious commercialism
right. That
became very popular, very effective, and I think we're still under the sweep of it today.
It's sort of an early form of Disney, isn't it?
Yes. Disney owes everything to P.T. Barnum and to George C. Tillio and a few others. But
before we go a little deeper into the 19th century or come into the 20th century, just talk to me about our contemporary culture a little bit here when it comes to this. Are we having fun today in the way that you see fun straining through American history in these examples that we've covered so far?
Yes and yes and no and no. It's the most populous forms of fun I don't think will ever go away. And I think that we're actually becoming very sophisticated in how we can pull pranks. And I think even our technology can play into that in certain ways. But I think the big threat right now in many ways is both our technology and this mass commercialization of fun that was engendered by P.T. Barnum, because they're so deceptive and they're so attractive that we feel like we're having fun when in fact we're just passively kind of receiving someone else's content, playing someone else's games,
sitting in our chairs. Right. So there's a lack of creativity. Yeah. Lack of creativity, would you say?
Yeah, I think creativity is what's most under fire these days.
Mm-hmm. And spontaneity?
The spontaneity. It's hard to be spontaneous when you're sitting back in your lounge chair with a console on your lap playing. Even though you feel like you're being spontaneous, Grand Theft Auto 5, you know, you're making these kind of binary decisions and you're lost in this imaginary world, which is absolutely not your own.
Do people do flash mobs anymore? Does that happen anymore?
Well, they're so 5 minutes ago, really. But I mean,
I know that, but it seemed to me like that was a.
I
kind of like that.
I think so. I like that too.
I even showed up at one of them once.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's kind of fun.
They are fun. I think they're one of the purest examples.
They've got a reputation for being sort of. Dangerous.
They did.
And
for good reason, because but they weren't, you know, truly dangerous. You know, the great author of so many flash mobs, this guy Charlie Todd of the Upright Citizens Brigade and Improv Everywhere. He kind of like in the construction of the Boston Tea Party, was really ingenious in how you construct these pranks, you know, having, you know, hundreds of people show up at a Best Buy dressed, you know, in blue T-shirts looking like Best Buy, Buy employees. You know, it wasn't illegal. It didn't hurt anyone, but it had this kind of edge to it, right? And it was purely fun, and it got people up and mingling with each other. But I can say one more thing about flash mobs. They, like everything else, like all of the very best populist fun were immediately commercialized. You had people, corporations hiring people to perform, you know, these well-choreographed flash mobs, and they, you know, went viral all in support of a bank or in support of
And people hate that contrived stuff.
Yes, and once you discover that it's
phony.
Contrived,
it's
the fun
phony.
Goes limp. It gets disgusting, right? That dumb Starbucks out in L.A. that turned out to, maybe don't know about this.
What did they do?
They constructed a Starbucks that looked exactly like a Starbucks, except it was called Dumb Starbucks. And people queued up around the block to get their Dumb Grande. And then it turned out to be an ad for this new show on Comedy Central, kind of killed it.
It's so disappointing when that happens.
Yeah.
So you got to look for your moments here, don't you?
Yeah. That's the challenge of creativity,
well, maybe
right?
Well, you don't look for... Yeah. I mean, it takes someone to sort of carry out a stunt of something.
Yeah, definitely.
Right? Or to say, hey, we're doing this... today, and
absolutely.
We're gonna go. We're gonna, I don't know. We're gonna bring all of our dogs to Annapolis.
It takes an entrepreneurial spirit. It takes a very complex mind in many ways. Yeah. You also have to, you know, calculate your risk.
You know, newspapers. I think radio stations used to do stunts
all
more.
The time.
They used to pull stunts more.
Certainly,
often,
War of
right?
the Worlds, right?
Yeah, War of the Worlds in broadcasting, of course, a great stunt. Now you couldn't get away with that today. You lose your license, your
right,
FCC
right.
license.
Right, everyone.
I don't know what's happening.
So,
are we that serious? I mean, what's going on here? Why doesn't this happen more often?
Well, huh? I'm still kind of haunted by yesterday and by April Fool's Day and what that has become. Because, you know, as I said, this was a vaunted day in the Wild West. And it has become this sort of a commercialized outlet. And so now these corporations with these big platforms, they all use this to kind of roll out their brand in a way that makes them seem folksy, makes them seem like fellow citizens. You know, Samuel Adams Beer released its, helium beer or something yesterday. It was a funny joke, right? They have good marketing people who, you know, tell good jokes, but they create the illusion that these corporations, just as the Citizens United ruling tells us, are actually individuals and they're people, right?
Right.
When in fact they're anything but.
Yeah. You're talking about something that happens at the grassroots.
Yes,
something that comes up, sort of happens organically because people want the experience of that fun,
right,
that you're talking about.
And sometimes the corporations are the object of that, and they shouldn't be thin-skinned about it when people like the Yes Men, you know, pull a joke at their expense.
I'm going to jump back to the early 20th century for you, because there's a couple of things here I need you to talk about. One is, well, Prohibition, I completely understand why this is in your book, because people want to be irreverent, challenge the system.
Right.
There was a lot of that going on during Prohibition, obviously.
Definitely.
Right? Yeah.
I think this is where the...
People were having a lot of fun.
Having a lot of fun and became very good at it. I think this is where the culture war that it was, you know, first glimpsed it at Marymount and, you know, kind of generated over the centuries went mainstream. It was like it really kind of seized the whole culture. You had the Puritans who had the small majority who had voted in Prohibition, and that was mostly a waspish majority. And then you had basically everyone else. You had people of all this ethnic variety, immigrant populations and African-American populations, and who just didn't see the sense in prohibiting alcohol, and they pushed back, and it generated all of these new avenues for fun. Jazz was fueling it. Flappers saw their political opportunity, and they got in the fun in very articulate and awesome ways.
A newspaper editor in Baltimore declared Maryland the free state. Maryland resented Prohibition.
Right. Excellent.
And one of my favorite stories that I picked up from Daniel Okrent, his book on Prohibition,
that's a great book,
was in Baltimore. Federal agents are coming to a warehouse here where they've suspected that there's whiskey and beer or something. And Baltimoreans ring the warehouse so that the federal agents can't get to it.
Fantastic.
You're not getting to our stuff, man.
Right.
Stay away from our still.
Right.
So they were having fun.
They were having fun and defending their fun. Yeah,
that
absolutely.
That was a 1920s flash mob
in
Baltimore.
The 20s were good for their flash mobs.
Yeah, yeah. John Beckman, you mentioned the marathon dancers or the marathon dance contests of the 20s and 30s, right? This is a Depression era.
Well, deep into the Depression era, that's actually when they became most popular.
Well, I got to tell you, I saw the movie years ago. They shoot horses,
Grim movie, right?
It's pretty grim.
Yeah,
it's
definitely.
Pretty, it's
dark.
A pretty dark movie. It didn't look like anybody was having any fun, at least in that film. So
well, that's kind of Horace McCoy's... presentation of it, definitely his kind of noirish little novel it came from is exactly the same way, and it's a certain reflection of maybe what marathon dancers did become when they became so popular and would grind on for days and became the sort of outlets for a lot of people who were also out of work. But there's plenty of evidence that marathon dances were also these great opportunities throughout their duration for people to kind of test themselves, enjoy themselves, get together, you know, with a throng out, you know.
Okay,
out in
so
public.
It wasn't all as dark as McCoy's
novel. No,
no. Okay.
You can present anything as dark as if you wish.
John, we run through the Depression. This seems a pretty grim time, but people found ways like this of amusing themselves or having some fun. Then we get through World War II.
Right.
We get to the 1950s.
Right.
And people are sort of dying for something, right? Again, having fun again, right? Is that why the 60s happened?
Well, I don't know if we were just kind of culturally restless. I think there's always this kind of dialectic, you know, going on, and several dialectics, you know, that generate synthesis maybe, but the 1960s did kind of come out of reaction to the button-down Eisenhower establishment of the 1950s. The avant-garde of that era were people like Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters, who kind of emerged from the Beat Generation of the late 60s, and you know through the CIA experiments in LSD, which Ken Kesey was actually part of, and they gave this completely zany and dazzling new spin on what culture can be. A lot of it arose from the pulling of pranks, the taking of drugs, the absolute flouting of any cultural expectations whatsoever, and this new massive youth generation. I think that was another key ingredient. There were just so many kids. Thought it was wonderful, and you know, between that and rock and roll and you know,
sex
and all the other, you know, actually quite buttoned down, you know, political protest movements, you know, from civil rights to free speech to the Students for the Democratic Society, this just kind of wave of resentment became also kind of a wave of cultural fun.
Ken Kesey wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yes.
His character, McMurphy, was all about trying to have fun, right?
Right. And he wrote a lot of that on acid, actually.
Yeah, I understand. And the Merry Pranksters drove around in this fabulous bus.
Yeah, wonderful. Called Further.
Further. Right. Mm-hmm. And did stuff,
They
right?
did stuff. Yeah, they were actually
What are we doing today?
Pranks.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the yippies and the hippies, by the way, what was the difference?
Well, the hippies were just kind of the general understanding of the long-haired counterculturalists, and the yippies were kind of poking fun at that stereotype and developed their own little political movement, the Youth International Party, or Yippie, and it was this kind of small cadre of troublemakers who pulled very intelligent pranks, like levitating the Pentagon.
Yes.
My employer.
When you push up to the 80s and the South Bronx and hip-hop.
70s, actually.
70s, 71. Actually. The South, the B-boys, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you see there? How does American fun get us there?
Well, as in the Wild West, as in slave culture, Bronx in 1971, as I put it in the book, was a war zone, and it was gangland. It was Fort Apache, the Bronx, and it was during this detente between the major warring gangs of the period that there was still all of this tension. You know, it was all this rivalry and vengeance over friends and gang members killed, that hip hop was born. This brother and sister team, Cindy and Clive Campbell, started throwing these basement rec room parties, and Clive engineered this new way of mixing groove into groove, which we now call hip hop, and of rapping into the mic, MCing, that blended very nicely with the spray paint tagging that they were all doing at the time, and then also with this new form of dance, b-boying, breakdancing, that arose from this. And so these four elements of hip hop became this really kind of competitive force through which the tensions of this era were channeled. And so the rivalries were still there. The potential for violence was there. The violence was still there.
Yeah.
But through the likes of Afrika Bambaataa's Zulu Nation, people got organized, and his motto was peace, love, and having fun. Peace, love, unity, and having fun. And this dance and this form of rapping actually became a political way to sort through people's problems.
Hey, one last thing. We're short of time now,
okay.
but marijuana, the legalization of marijuana.
Yeah,
I mean, when I see these crowds of people in Colorado and Washington State and other places here in Maryland, you know, demonstrating for decriminalization, legalization, these look like people who just want to have fun, right?
Yeah, well, certainly, yeah.
And Governor Moonbeam in California, Jerry Brown, says we need to be an alert nation.
Right.
We need to be more serious of purpose, right?
Yes, well. I don't know. I simply don't know where to begin on the legalization of marijuana, though. Certainly the medical marijuana in some ways does seem like a canard.
Well, but there is that strain of fun in that, right?
Oh, certainly.
As you would see in Prohibition, for instance.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, John, this has been fun.
It's been great fun, Dan.
Oh,
yeah.
I can't believe I said that.
It's hard to avoid it, right?
Anyway, American Fun is the name of John Beckman's book. Pantheon is the publisher, although you can't tell that from the spine of the jacket because it's been spray-painted over. American Fun, Four Centuries of a Joyous Revolt. And John Beckman's been our guest, visiting us from the U.S. Naval Academy, where he's a professor of English there and an accomplished novelist. Thank you, John. Yeah,
thank you very much, Dan. It's been great fun.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. See you again soon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Luke Spicknell, James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.